Life, said the critic James Haneke, is like an onion. You peel off layer after layer, only to discover at the end there's nothing in it, except tears. I think this woman of Samaria would have agreed with that verdict. It's not difficult, from the little we're told about her, to imagine the kind of person she was, is it? I guess, like most of us, she was looking for happiness. But unfortunately, happiness kept on eluding her grasp. The current man in her life, we're told, was number six. Some of our advocates of the permissive society and feminine emancipation would no doubt hail this as a testimony to the unfettered joy of sexual liberation. But I'm pretty sure she didn't see it that way. She had hoped, like many, that love and marriage would make her life worthwhile. Give it meaning, give it direction. But somehow every relationship had turned sour on her. Each time she'd found a new man, she'd thought, ah, at last, this is it, my Mr. Right. I won't make the same mistake again. But she did. And the more emotional tragedy she experienced, the more onion-like her life became. Already the romantic idealism of her youth had hardened into a frustrated cynicism about things. And as far as the future, well, it didn't bear thinking about. Age would steal her beauty. Her men friends would turn to younger sport. There would be little left for her except the gutter. She could see herself in it now, a loathsome old piece of laced mutton, pathetically courting the favours of any man drunk enough or desperate enough to want her, maybe. If the truth were known, she was already halfway there. As already her self-respect was in tatters, why else should she choose to come to this isolated traveller's well at the hottest time of the day, except to avoid the embarrassment of being shunned by all those respectable neighbours of hers? What she wouldn't give for something to relieve the depression that haunted her. She felt so insecure, so lonely, but most of all, she felt so dissatisfied. In the small hours, wrote Cyril Connolly, when the acrid stench of existence rises like sewer gas from everything created, the emptiness of life seems more terrible than its misery. Yes, this woman knew about those small hours that Connolly speaks about. Those sleepless nights, born not of overwork, but simply of the unremitting futility of it all. Take that wretched water pot she'd carried from the village, for instance. There it stood, empty again. She'd filled it yesterday. She would fill it again tomorrow. It was like her life, a symbol of never-ending thirst. She would spend the remainder of her days filling that pot, and at the end its appetite would be as insatiable as ever. I don't know if you've ever had one of those days when you felt so irritated you wanted to smash a perfectly innocent piece of pottery against the wall. But I suspect this woman sometimes felt like that about her water pot. Empty, empty again. That was her water pot. That was her. Is it maybe you this morning? Kirk Douglas, the Hollywood actor, once likened his life to the script of a second feature movie. It's that corny, he said. If someone offered me the screenplay of my life to film, I'd turn it down flat. There are millions of people with lives far less exciting than Kirk Douglas's who would say something similar. Bored, bored, out of their minds, the sheer tedium of existence, like a rat trapped in an insoluble maze, like a wheel caught in a never-ending rut. They long for something to shatter the monotony, to fill the vacuum. But the irony is they don't even know what it is they really want, let alone where to find it. They try another job. They try another marriage. They try alcohol, they try drugs. They try the ersatz thrill of the latest fantasy movie. They try the hypnotic stupor of the TV screen. They try the Paul's coupon and the holiday brochure. They try the Mills Boon romance and page 3 of The Sun. But none of it works. At best, they offer no more than temporary escape. The small hours, those sleepless small hours, always return. And with them, the emptiness. No, we don't really need John to spell out what the woman of Samaria felt about life, do we? For she is a woman in whose face we can see mirrored the inner anguish of millions. Millions who daily peel off the layers of their onion-like existence, only to discover nothing. Nothing but tears, that is. Well, there may be some parts of John's Gospel that we will find hard to relate to. But no one can say this woman isn't relevant to the 20th century, can they? You can see a thousand of her within a square mile of this chapel. And that being so, I hope you're going to listen very hard this morning. For you see, our study this morning tells us how one day, quite out of the blue, quite unexpectedly, this woman, this empty woman, who in the space met someone who in the space of a single conversation transformed her emptiness into a sparkling fountain of satisfaction and joy. That's the story today. And John recounts her story to us because he's convinced that that same someone can do the same for us. So let's follow the encounter through, shall we? You'll see on the bulletin, we're going to look at it in five stages. Five stages of this life-changing conversation with Jesus. Five stages which in many ways parallel any encounter with Christ that you may speak of. First, a question of curiosity. Secondly, a sense of need. Thirdly, a stab of conscience. Fourth, a response of heart. And fifthly, a commitment. A commitment to Jesus. Start first with a question of curiosity. Jesus had to go through Samaria. He came to a town in Samaria called Sychar and sat down, tired, by the well. It was about the sixth hour. And when a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" It's interesting, John starts off there by saying that Jesus had to go through Samaria, because the fact is there was no had to about it at all, humanly speaking. Pious Jews avoided that particular route like the plague, preferring to go several miles out of their way rather than risk social intercourse with these despised Samaritans. If Jesus had been in some particular hurry, I suppose his breach of normal practice might have been understandable. But there's no evidence to suggest that his journey was a particularly urgent one. Quite the opposite, in fact. Verses 1 to 3 indicate that had it not been for some animosity in Jerusalem, Jesus would have stayed in Judea longer. He certainly is conscious of no pressing reason for getting back to Galilee. The only reason, then, for saying Jesus had to go through Samaria must be that an important encounter awaited him en route. It is, in other words, John's subtle way of telling us that this meeting with the woman of Samaria was no chance matter. It took place, like everything in Jesus' life, by divine appointment. There was a must about it. Not that the woman had any idea of that, of course. Not that Jesus gave her any hint of it in his opening remark to her. Unlike some Christians who would heavy in with boorish questions like, "Are you saved, sister?" Jesus is a model of tact and discretion. "Will you give me a drink?" he says. No hint that there's going to be a religious element in this conversation at all. And yet, you see, the interest of the woman is aroused by the remark. "You're a Jew and I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink?" she says. The reason for her surprise is simple. Jesus was flouting two deeply embedded social conventions of his day. First, he was ignoring the hatred which had kept Jews and Samaritans in mutually exclusive communities for four centuries. As John puts it, Jews do not associate with Samaritans. That's putting it mildly. Secondly, though, Jesus was ignoring the gentlemanly decorum which forbade any respectable Middle Eastern man from having a private exchange with a woman in public. The rabbis held it was even improper for a husband to talk to his wife in public. What they would have thought about a man chatting to a woman of such mongrel pedigree and such low moral reputation as this one is nobody's business. Little wonder then the woman is taken aback by this strange Jew who wants to talk to her, a Samaritan woman. And of course there's a moving lesson for us in that, isn't there? Jesus is not bothered who you are. Not in the least bothered who you are or what the world thinks of you. He is not hampered in his dealings with people by those discriminations which affect us so much, be they racist or sexist or whatever they be. Maybe society has given us a low self-image. Maybe society has told us we're not worth much because we're black, we're working class, or even we're just a woman. Jesus doesn't think like that. Last week, if you remember, we saw him talking to a male Jewish aristocrat, Nicodemus. This week, he's talking to a female Samaritan peasant. The social contrast could not be more extreme. But Jesus speaks to both with equal concern, with equal respect. So I say to you, whoever you are this morning, you need have no fear that Jesus isn't interested in you. On the contrary, he may well have come to this church this morning specifically to meet with you. Oh, you don't realize it yet, of course. Any more than did this woman of Samaria. All you feel at present is a mild curiosity. You've met some Christian, maybe, and you've seen they're a bit different. You've read a bit of the Bible, and perhaps it seems strange. You've come along because you're interested to see what goes on in that funny-looking building on the corner of Fitzroy Street on Sunday morning. A mild curiosity, that's all you feel. Well, be warned. For once you're in conversation with Jesus Christ, anything could happen. That's how it began for this woman. A question of curiosity. But it didn't stay like that for long. It moved on to a sense of need. Look at verse 10. Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God, and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." So the small talk is quickly dispensed with. With the skill of a master conversationalist, Jesus breaks through the chit-chat to challenge that spiritual emptiness in this woman's life, of which we've already spoken this morning. It's not surprising. She's not really prepared to be maneuvered into a religious conversation of that sort quite so easily. "Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob?" she replies. Commentators differ about how he ought to take that retort. Some think she's genuinely misunderstood Jesus. She's taken his words about living water literally and thinks he's offering to tell her about some hidden spring or other nearby. And knowing the place as well as she does, she's understandably sceptical. But personally, I think that's a rather unlikely explanation. She's an intelligent woman. She knew that Jesus was bantering with her, that he was playing word games with her. This is the sort of woman who'd been chatted up by enough men to know when they were working some conversational angle. She wasn't naive. But she decided, I think, to play along. I suspect there was a mischievous glint in her eye, perhaps even a hint of flirtatiousness. As she retorts to what she took to be Jesus' little jest, with feigned indignation. "Oh, that's big talk, that is. Who do you think you are, then? Tormenting a poor working girl like me with offers of running water, when you haven't even got a bucket to help yourself to this stagnant pool you're sitting on. Obviously, water that was good enough for the patriarchs isn't good enough for the likes of you, is it?" But Jesus is not to be diverted from his purpose so easily. He repeats, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks the water I give him will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give him will become in him a spring of water, welling up to eternal life." Have you ever been walking in Scotland or Wales? It's one of the things I like to do when I get some time off. And you find yourself in the middle of nowhere with an empty flask and a long way to go. Then suddenly you stumble on one of those little ice-cold mountain streams that flows down from the rocks, crystal clear, sparkling, invigorating, refreshing, better than anything the East Anglian Water Board can provide. That's what Jesus says he can give to men and women. A kind of inner fountain of bubbling vitality that satisfies a person's spiritual thirst, not just once, but permanently, eternally. He's saying, in other words, that he's the answer to that emptiness that gnaws our souls as it gnawed this woman's soul. Life with him is no onion, it's a cascade of fulfillment and joy, he says. And this time the woman's reply is just a little bit less dismissive. Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water. Once again, I strongly suspect that there is an element of playfulness in her words. I think she's being sarcastic. She's urging him, please give me some of this wonderful water, sir. I can't wait. Carting this water pot to and fro every day is driving me slowly up the wall. You can imagine a woman bantering in that way. But don't you feel there is, at the very least, a certain wistfulness underlying her words, even if they are flippant? For all her humour, Jesus has struck a serious chord in her heart. It's as if she's saying, it would be a very nice trick if you could do it, stranger. Would that you could wave your magic wand and free me from this cycle of drudgery to which I'm victim. And for Jesus, that invitation, half joking though it may well have been, that was enough. All he was after was some conscious confession on this woman's part of her sense of need. That's all he was after. The trouble with most of us, you see, is we are not willing to make such a confession. We insist on pretending everything's okay. Because if the truth were known, we all live a lot closer to despair than we can afford to admit. So we erect all kinds of defense mechanisms, don't we, against anything that threatens to expose our inward spiritual poverty. Light-hearted self-mockery being one of the most common. Me, get religious. Oh yes, I could just fancy myself in a halo, we say. But deep down, you see, beneath that tongue-in-the-cheek humour, there's a real spiritual longing, isn't there? It wouldn't joke about it if it weren't so. Well, listen to me. If you're going to find Jesus' answer to that emptiness I've spoken of, you've got to be willing to confess your need. Jesus put it once this way. He said, people who are healthy don't need a doctor. Only those who are sick. What can a doctor do for a patient who refuses to admit he's got a problem? He can't do anything. So don't come to Dr. Jesus this morning telling him you're fine. If you do that, you'll leave this place completely unchanged. It will do you no good at all. Now come here, willing to admit that your life is empty. Willing to tell him that you're longing for something to satisfy your spiritual thirst. That like that psalmist we were reading about earlier, your soul is longing, panting for the living God. Say something like that to him, and he'll be at your side in a moment. You're well on the way to leaving this place changed. So be warned, once you do admit a need to Dr. Jesus, no matter how sardonically, you may well find he will prescribe surgery before he gets down to giving you the medicine you're after. And that brings us to the third stage in the conversation, a stab of conscience. Look at verse 16. He told her, go call your husband and come back. I have no husband, she replied. Jesus said to her, you're right when you say you have no husband. The fact is you've had five husbands. And the man you now have is not your husband. What you've just said is quite true. See, Jesus can be sarcastic too when he wants to be. Why does Jesus suddenly introduce this sordid dimension into the conversation, do you think? Surely this woman's love life is her own concern. All Jesus is doing by such an unwarranted intrusion into her private affairs is to risk her storming off in fury with all kinds of how dare yous and I don't have to put up with this falling on the ear. Up till now, Jesus had been a model of discretion. Why does he now suddenly display such uncharacteristic tactlessness? Well, the answer, of course, is that he has to. Not just in the case of this Samaritan woman, in the case of all of us. We assume, you see, that the root of our emptiness is boredom. If our life were more interesting, we say, it would be okay. If only I could find the right job. If only I could find the right marriage partner. Then my feelings of frustration and dissatisfaction with life would all evaporate. Countless thousands of people say that to themselves. But it isn't so. It isn't so. Our real problem is not with our jobs, not even with our marriages. Our real problem is with ourselves. Isn't that true? It is at root not circumstantial in origin, this emptiness. It is moral. We human beings were made by God with certain behavioural norms in mind, and we have deliberately flouted those norms. We've rebelled against God's rules for our lives like disobedient children kicking against their parents' authority, and God has locked us in the bedroom to teach us a lesson. Of course we feel bored up there. Of course we feel empty inside. We're designed to share the life of God with him. But our foolish insistence on our own way has severed that relationship and the water of life that flows from it, and it has left us lonely, insecure, directionless, at odds with ourselves, at odds with one another, at odds even with the universe. And what do we do in response? Well, we spend all our days trying to plug that gap which God's absence has left, don't we? As often as not, these days, we try and plug it as this woman did, with sexual adventure. But it never works. For no human relationship, no matter how emotionally intense, can substitute for the relationship with God we were made for. Now, before Jesus can meet our need, he has to show us the diagnosis. And the diagnosis is our moral failure. And that is almost always a painful experience to have that exposed to us. I know there's a story told of a Mexican who was arrested outside a police station for while admiring his own photograph on his wanted poster. But most of us find guilt something we would far rather not face up to. Certainly not something we admire in ourselves, is it? It's something that makes us feel ashamed, something that makes us feel embarrassed. But Jesus insists, it's not enough just to admit you have a sense of need. You must also be willing to admit a sense of sin. There can't be any finding of answers until that surgery has been done. Speaking frankly, you know, we all have our moral skeletons in the cupboard, don't we? We all have things in our lives that we can't remember without feeling embarrassed about them. We all have thoughts lurking in our imaginations that would make us blush if they were displayed on that video screen out there. But such is our pride that most of us engage in a kind of inner psychological conspiracy to conceal that secret shame from everybody, even from ourselves. We think we're safe. We can pretend we're good people. We can even believe that lie ourselves. But I have to tell you, it isn't so. Jesus sees through our subterfuge. There is no way we can hide from him those things we hide from other people or even try to hide from ourselves. There's nothing hidden he can't see. Our lives are transparent to his gaze. He sees those deeds. He sees those thoughts as clearly as he saw this woman's six love affairs. And he insists that we see them too. He insists that we build this new kind of life he wants to give us on the humiliating self-knowledge that we are fallen, that we are failures, that we are spiritual bankrupts, that we are sinners. He won't let us get away with anything less than that. For the water of life we are looking for is the gift of God, and God gives it by a policy which he strictly adheres to, only to the penitent. Only to the penitent. And that brings us to the fourth stage in the conversation. A response of heart. Look at verse 19. The woman said, I can see that you're a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem, she says. Now, most commentators interpret this as a red herring thrown into the conversation by this woman in a desperate attempt to change the subject. And I'm sure, in measure, that's exactly what it was. Nobody likes talking about their sin longer than they have to. Theology is a much less threatening subject. Oh, yes, let's talk about theology, Jesus. Those of you who've had any experience at all in counselling people, in talking to them about their spiritual need, you know just how frequently this kind of particular red herring is fished up in order to divert attention from more personal issues. What about the pagans? And what about other religions? What about all these Christian denominations? It's the same thing. Jerusalem or Samaria. And it's true, often it is no more than a smokescreen with which people are trying to avoid the moral challenge of the Bible. But to give her her due, I feel that this woman, in her case, it was more than that. You see, Jesus' exposure of her immoral lifestyle had gone home. It had made a profound impact on her. If you look on to verse 39, you'll see that. He told me everything I ever did. Verse 29, come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. And it had really gone home that he had exposed this immorality in her life. She may have been grateful to get off the subject of her previous husbands. But the question she raises here, I don't think was necessarily a mere ploy. She had suddenly realized that this man she had taken for a rather liberal-minded Jew was nothing less than a prophet with supernatural knowledge of her sin. And she knew enough about religion to realize that in such an encounter, she was being summoned to get right with God. But the obvious question for a woman with her particular background was, well, where do I do that? You point at my sin, you tell me my life is wrong. Where do I compensate for it? Where do I offer sacrifice for it? Where do I try and make it right? At the temple in Jerusalem or the one at Samaria? It may have been partly a red herring, but it was also partly a valid question. Of course, the multitude of world religions can often be a mere diversionary tactic, but it can also be a genuine intellectual problem for people, and it does need an answer. And Jesus graciously gives one. Verse 21. Believe me, woman, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you don't know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for they are the kind of worshippers the Father seeks. God is spirit. And his worshippers must worship in spirit and in truth. Now, these are vitally important words expressing some very important things about what Christianity is. Will you notice first with me what Jesus does not say? He does not say here what our hyper-tolerant, pluralist, liberal 20th century world would very much want him to say. He doesn't say, ah, well, all religions are true, you know. We would like him to say that, of course. We'd like him to mouth comforting platitudes about the difference between Jews and Samaritans being superficial and historical. And we would like him to praise Samaritan culture and religion and urge that Samaritans are already finding God their own way and so forth. We would like him to echo Gandhi's opinion that the soul of all religions is one and it's only in outward form that they differ. But Jesus says nothing of the kind. On the contrary, if you look carefully, you will see here that Jesus insists upon the unique religious privilege of the Jewish people as the historical locus both of divine revelation and divine redemption. We worship what we know, he says. You don't. Now, if that was embarrassing or offensive to this woman's Samaritan pride, Jesus does not spare her pride. You Samaritans don't know what you worship. We do, he says. Salvation is from the Jews. The Jew alone, within the spectrum of world religions, is the recipient of the Word of God, the Word of Revelation, delivering him from the superstition and the speculation of human ignorance. What's more, nobody's ever going to find spiritual emancipation in this world, he says, unless they have dealings with the Jews. For deliverance from sin is something which God has accomplished inescapably in a context of Jewish history and Jewish culture. Salvation is from the Jews, he says. Well, it's exclusivist and particularist. It offends many. But Jesus insists that is the way it is. The Jews were the chosen people of God. If we are disposed to call that unfair, he might have replied the Jews have paid for their privilege many times over the centuries. So important we understand this, you see. Now, there's a tendency these days to want to bathe in an orgy of nationalistic sentiment, whoever we are. You saw a bit of it at the last night of the proms yesterday, to show you the British are still capable of it. May come mightier yet, and all that stuff. Go to Africa, go to China, to India. In many of the developing countries, you find this kind of strong nationalistic fervor that will not accept we're indebted to any other culture than our own. But it is not true. Every one of us, whichever culture we come from, British, Chinese, Indian, Russian, Ethiopian, African, whatever it is, we depend upon the Jewish people for our knowledge of God and for the way salvation has come to us. The Bible makes that abundantly clear. We can't escape from it. If you had asked the question this woman asks 30 years before she asked it, on which mountain should we worship the Father? The answer would have been Jerusalem. Without any question, the answer would have been Jerusalem. But what I want you to notice is that Jesus goes beyond that in his own reply. Woman, he says, believe me, you stand on the threshold of a new age. A new era is dawning. A new hour is coming. Yes, it's already come. And he says one of the characteristics of that new age, that new hour, will be that access to God is no longer tied to any one race or nation as it was in the past. The historical privileges of the Jews will become obsolete, he says, irrelevant. It will neither be a matter of Jerusalem or Samaria. In the new age, he says, it's going to be a matter of spirit and truth. Now, we need to be very careful interpreting what Jesus means by those enigmatic words. It's often said, of course, that what Jesus is getting at here is that God is spirit. That is, he's non-material. He's not localized in any particular place. So it's not a question of where you worship, but how. You should worship sincerely, in spirit and in truth. Now, up to a point, that is true. It's undoubtedly Jesus' intention in these words, spirit and truth, to emphasize that true worship isn't a matter of mere form. It's a matter of heart. That we can be absolutely clear about. However, if we said no more than that, we could be excused in thinking that Jesus is endorsing precisely the kind of liberal universalism that is so appealing to 20th century man, isn't it? It doesn't matter what you believe, so long as you're sincere. Is Jesus saying the same? It doesn't matter where you worship, so long as you worship in spirit and truth. But that would be completely to misunderstand what Jesus is getting at. For you see, the fact is, heart attitude has always been necessary to true worship. That's nothing new. God has always despised cant and hypocrisy. He's never been satisfied with mere religious formality. The sacrifices of God are a broken and a contrite heart, says David. Rend your hearts, not your garments. There's nothing new in that. And yet Jesus is here quite distinctly speaking about a radical change in the way in which men and women relate to God. A new hour, he says, a new age. Clearly, spirit and truth, then, can't just be mere synonyms for sincerity. There must be something more to it than that, and there is. Because if you study John's Gospel as a whole, you will quickly discover that these words, spirit and truth, are key words in his vocabulary, and they're not trite or trivial in their meaning. They're very far-reaching. They're very profound words. We can't possibly do justice to them in the 5 minutes we've got left this morning. Suffice it to say this. The vital thing about these words, spirit and truth, when John uses them, is that they are very, very closely bound up with the person and ministry of Jesus himself. When John speaks of spirit, he's not actually emphasizing that God is non-material. When John speaks of spirit, he's talking about the distinctive life which God has, and which in this new age becomes available to men and women through Jesus. So we find Jesus saying, the words I speak to you, they are spirit. They are life. And when John speaks of truth, he does not mean mere sincerity of heart. He's talking about the inner reality of God's being, which has never been fully seen, but which in the New Age actually becomes visible to men through Jesus. So he can say the law came through Moses, but truth comes through Jesus Christ. I see, when you realize that, and it's easy to see that far from endorsing a kind of bland universalism in these words, spirit and truth, Jesus is in fact doing the very opposite. He's telling us here, it's no more a case of everybody worshipping God in his own way in the New Age than it was in the Old Age. The exclusiveness of the Jews has been demolished in the New Age, that's true, but it's been replaced by a new kind of exclusiveness. The exclusiveness of Jesus. True worshippers must worship the Father in spirit and truth. And what John means by those words can relate only to the man Jesus is and what he's done. I am the way, the truth, and the life, says Jesus. No one comes to the Father except by me. It is then only people who've received the spiritual life and the spiritual reality of God, which Jesus brings, whom Jesus says are the true worshippers, whom God is looking for in the New Age. It's a heart response, all right. But it's not a heart response to some vague, generalized idea of God. It's a heart response to Jesus himself. And that brings us to the fifth element in the conversation. The woman said, I know that Messiah, called Christ, is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us. Then Jesus declared, I, who speak to you, am he. Now you see, if you're going to get the full power of that final affirmation by Jesus, you have to realize that what John actually wrote was not, I who am speaking to you am he. He wrote, I who am speaking to you, I am. That's the way he expresses it. I am. And to a person like this woman, familiar with the Old Testament, such a bald and unqualified use of the first person of the verb to be would be shatteringly bold, perhaps even blasphemous. See, long before Moses had stood before God with the burning bush before his eyes, what's your name, he said, when I see the people, what shall I tell you you're called? I am that I am, said God. Tell them I am has sent you. That's my name. So Jesus here, you see, is not only claiming identity with the Messiah. He's as good as claiming identity with God. I am, he says. It's a majestic statement. This eternal life, he says, what I've been talking about, this water which will satisfy you, it's not an article that you can add to your list of personal possessions. No, Jesus is life personified. I am, he says. Jesus gives us life by giving himself to us. In him is life. Eternal life is nothing more nor less than a relationship with him. The answer to our need is not a new religious technique, not even a new religious experience in a way. It is a relationship with Jesus the Living One. And it is to such a relationship, such a mutual commitment, that Jesus invites this woman at the close of their conversation. And just look at the effect it has on her. In verse 28, leaving her water jar, says John. John's a master of that little detail. The symbol of her emptiness, there it was, abandoned at his feet. She'd found the living water. Things would never be the same again. Some of you, many of you I know, are Christians. What does Jesus say to us out of that story this morning? Isn't he saying something like this? Look, all around you, there are people like that woman. empty lives. You can meet them practically anywhere. Some of you may be disposed to say, he says, we must wait for a revival. When revival comes, then there'll be many, many people turning to God, becoming Christians. Now, says Jesus, don't talk like that. The harvest is already here. No matter waiting 4 months, the harvest is already here, all around you. Just open your eyes and look. The fields are white to harvest. There are people like this woman everywhere. You don't have to wait for anything. You simply have to start talking to them. Start engaging them in conversation, as I did. Awaken their curiosity. Awaken their sense of need. Offer them the Savior, and you will find they too leave their water pots. Others of you here, I know, are not Christians. What is Jesus saying to you this morning? Is he perhaps saying, just as he said to that woman, if only you knew what God was willing to give you, if only you realized who this Jesus is that we're talking about, then you would go to him this morning, and you would ask him, and he would give you the water of life, just as he gave it to that woman. The steps are simple. Admit your need. Stop pretending you're okay. Face up to the fact you're empty. Admit your sin. Stop trying to blame other things. Accept the fact that it is your moral failure that has broken the tie between you and God and left you in this vacuum of emptiness you feel. And commit yourself to Jesus. Jesus doesn't ask that you abandon your cultural identity. He doesn't say you have to become a Jew or a Samaritan or anything like that. He doesn't give you a long list of rules to keep. He doesn't tell you it's a pilgrimage you must go on. He doesn't give you some rituals to perform. He simply says, ask me. Come to me, realizing who I am. And ask me for the water of life. Let's pray together.